you can host the best backyard barbecue. When you find a professional on Angie to make your backyard the best around. Connect with skilled professionals to get all your home projects done well. Inside to outside, repairs to renovations. Get started on the Angie app or visit Angie.com today. You can do this when you Angie that.
All ministers and officials should now go to Case Orange. Repeat, this is an official colonial government broadcast.
And welcome to the Battlestar Galacticast, brought to you by Sci-Fi Wire here at Emerald City Comic Con!
Sci-Fi Wire!
My name is Mark Bernardin.
And I am Trisha Helfer.
Hey!
Hey!
Hi, Trisha.
Hi, Mark.
It's like we're totally at your house, except all of these people are here.
Yes! They're kind of making me nervous.
Yeah, if you are not familiar with the Battlestar Galacticast, which you should be, and if you're not familiar, why are you here? Trisha and I host a episode-by-episode rewatch of Battlestar Galactica. We do it from Trisha's house. There are approximately 45,000 cats in Trisha's house. I am deathly allergic to cats, and yet I still go to Trisha's house because she's so awesome.
So if you guys want to purr, then, you know, every once in a while we'll get a purring.
Yeah, and we expect a fight to break out somewhere that Trisha has to break up.
Yeah.
So
it'll feel like any normal podcast of the Battlestar Galacticast.
Totally.
Instead of a special one. But this one is a special one. We are here in Seattle with you guys. I'm very happy to be here. And we have a very special guest.
It's so special, it's almost not even funny. The last guest we had on the podcast was Ronald D. Moore, the showrunner, creator, developer, the wizard of all things, who came to Trisha's house and helped navigate the cats with me.
And we talked Kobold's Last Gleaming, too.
And we told Kobold's Last Gleaming Part 2, including the rest of the first season and stuff. But he's special enough, but he's not like...
He's not like president special.
No, he's not. He doesn't have his own ship, you know, that changes name when he gets on it. You know, like he doesn't have like a body man who like just hands him stuff and tells him what he needs to know on any given day. He doesn't have a code name.
No.
No, but our guest does.
Our guest does. I think we should bring her out.
Should we?
Yeah.
All right. Hey, everybody, put your hands together for your president and mine, Mary McDonough.
Hi, everyone.
I'll put you in the middle. I'll put you in the middle.
All the way in.
Oh, that's the middle.
We're going to sandwich you.
Yeah. Hi. Hey!
I just want to tell everybody I'm about to announce my candidacy for the 2020 Democratic primary.
Well, I know who I'm
going for. She was president of the colonies. I think she could handle, you know. Hi.
Hey!
Yay.
So yeah, it's a little weird because we're not at your house and there's no wine.
And there's no wine. Normally, the way we do this, if you haven't seen the Galacticast, is we normally kind of dissect an episode. So, this is the first season of the Galacticast, and this is our final taping of the first season, and. So we're going to have some, I'm totally not making sense. We're going to have some fan questions at the end. But what we've decided to do for this, because we're not talking about a specific episode like we normally do, we're going to kind of loosely base this chat about the theme of responsibility. And Laura's responsibility, Laura Roslin's, to the fleet and to herself. Mary, yours as a performer, to yourself and to the cast, being, you know, a leader and a performer. Into your family, and also the show's responsibility in its portrayal of the extremes of the human condition. So when we get to the fan questions, kind of keep that in mind and go along those routes. Like, don't ask her what she thinks about the final five.
I won't tell you.
Yeah, and we try to keep the podcast relatively spoiler-free. We failed at that. We've had guests who failed at that. Eddie was, like, way too loose-lipped about everything.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I feel like I just broke some sacred ground by calling him Eddie. I suddenly feel weird about that.
No, it's okay. Get over it.
but first, let's do a little bit of backup. Let's start as closest to the beginning as we're gonna. Unless I've been mistaken, and even though you've done your fair share of television before Battlestar Galactica, both ERs you were on. And if you didn't know there was an ER before ER, YouTube is your friend. What was it about this that called to you? What was it about this particular script and this project and the idea of revisiting Battlestar Galactica?
Well, for me, it wasn't a revisit. I hadn't seen the original, and I didn't really know anything about it because at the time that the original Battlestar Galactica aired, I was in New York City, I was doing theater, I didn't have a television, I didn't see any of it. So to me, it was like a brand new idea. And when I read this, when I heard that they wanted to offer me this role, I actually laughed. I thought, I just didn't see, you know, Stands with Fists on the Prairie up in the sky and in sci-fi. It didn't make sense. And I read it and realized how grounded in humanity and how prescient and how unbelievably incredible it was going to be for women. All the characters. This one, Starbuck. Great, everybody, all the women, and that was in the pilot. So I was sold. It took me like one day to say, what do we have to do? But I must admit, I met with them and I said, I only have one question. And he said, yeah, Ron, you know, he's quiet, thoughtful, kind. I said, is this a long job or a very short job? Because my first scene, I get diagnosed with fatal cancer. And I just needed to know, am I just doing a little tiny thing here, you know? And bless his heart, he said to me at that breakfast, oh, no, no, no. We won't lose Laura Roslin till the end, the last episode when they finally find Earth.
The fact that he knew that then.
He knew it. And I said, well, how will she? He goes, oh, there's all kinds of things we'll find for her. Like Kamala. You know, so.
Like drugs.
Was there any, like drugs. Was there any trepidation, you know, as an actor, you're always traveling, right? We just travel all over for where the job takes us. But you'd been a lot in LA, right? Or for movies where you'd go off for a short period of time. But knowing that the miniseries was a backdoor pilot, was there any trepidation going, okay, I'm this series, if it goes to series, it's gonna be out of the country. And I think your children were 12 and like 14 at the time or something?
Yeah, Olivia, well, I think Olivia was in high school and Michael was 11 when we started, yeah. Yes, there was. I mean, I knew that this would be probably the first arc in my life as an actress mother where I was consistently leaving them and I couldn't bring them.
Because not like toddlers
know?
Where you can
when
just...
When toddlers you can bring them.
Yeah.
You know, and so yes, there was. But I also felt that they were older and they knew what it was to have an actor mom and an actor dad and they loved to travel themselves. As it turns out, Vancouver is still Michael's, one of his favorite places on the planet. So it worked out well, yeah.
And also given that, I mean, Battlestar, the cast, it's a phenomenal cast. I mean, soup to nuts. There's not a bad choice among them. But many of them hadn't done much before, or especially much American work, and in some cases hadn't ever acted on screen before. What did you feel was your role towards actors like that? You know, especially being, for the first time, like a lead on a drama series, you know, a co-lead on a drama series. How much of that responsibility did you take onto your shoulders?
Well, I think that when, as any of them would and certainly do now, when you are working with actors who are new and you can see where their gift is, I think what you try to do in conversation is to keep them grounded in what they have to bring. There's not a big mystery to how you get from there to there. It's really you. And so I think that if there was any advice, see, I wasn't on the set with them much. I was isolated on Colonial One. So I didn't work a lot with any of these people for a long time. It took me a while before, when they started bringing Laura Roslin over onto the ship, and she became more involved with whatever was actually really going on, and she and Adama were really running the thing together. That's when I really got to know all these amazing actors, but I would see them at read-throughs, do you know? But these people, Trisha Helfer, she walked in, and I remember thinking the first day watching her, and I'm going, okay, correct me if I'm wrong, but this woman was a model, and she hasn't done a lot of acting, and this is an absolute dynamo powerhouse, right? And so you look at that, there isn't a lot you have to offer. You're like, oh, this is gonna be great.
But you know where, and thank you.
You're welcome.
I appreciate that. But it stems from the top. It really does, not only in bringing your A game, but when you're improved by when you're with some, when you can play, when you can bounce back and forth,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
But one of the things that you know also stuck out to me was aside from not just on set stuff, I mean on set, but like one of the things you did for me was being there as a friend and as somebody that, do you remember when we were going through the whole like lighting issue?
I'll never forget it.
I mean, I was one of the newest actors on set, but I was probably, especially out of the leads, one of the oldest women.
Isn't that amazing?
Right?
Other than me, of course.
I was 29 and 30 when we started, or 31 when we started filming the series. And there was an issue that they had with my look, because we went from film to high definition. And a different director of photography who was lighting me differently. And I was supposed to be the one that stuck out as this kind of ethereal thing. So you have to light that properly. And I was being told I looked bad. And you took me aside, even though we weren't working together at that point, really.
Yeah.
We had, I think it was, you know, one scene in Colonial Rhapsody.
You, me and James.
Yeah. Yes. Yeah. And you took me aside, you went out of your way to take me aside to talk to me about it and give me strength to have a backbone and not to let it affect me so much. So that's what you do as that you did as a leader.
Thank you.
Without even really, you didn't think about it. You just stepped in and helped me as a friend and as a woman.
Well, thank you, Trisha. Jeez. Well, the thing, by the time I reached Battlestar Galactica, the dilemma of women in lighting, I knew it well. You know what I mean? And it never ends, does it? And
no,
so,
you're not allowed to have wrinkles if you're a woman, or to have, if you're tired, to have bags. You are if you're a guy.
or the opposite is true, is that if you've had a bad day, they take the filters off the lenses and go, ooh, doesn't she look awful? That's awesome. You know what I mean? You're like, wait a minute, you know what? I have to support a family of four. You put those filters back on the lenses now. And, you know, if you say it forcefully enough, they do it.
I mean, it's like the hardest part about watching Battlestar Galactica today. And it's only hard because, well, I mean, the contrast between the president of the colonies,
yes,
and the president of the United States.
All right, no.
You know, so like, you know, one of them seems to be able to hold a civilization together by the grit of her teeth and the sterling of her jaw, and the other one can be provoked by a tweet. So, where did you draw your inspiration from? Where did you amass the elements of what you thought that kind of leader was going to be?
That's a really good question. I will say another thing that Trisha and I shared and all the women shared was at the time we were doing Battlestar, it was the first primary with Hillary and Barack. And so there was already a woman out there with the set of the jaw and the stamina and the groundedness. Do you know what I mean? And so Hillary was out there. And so that was one thing. There have been tremendous women in politics in my lifetime. They weren't as visible as we are now, which is glorious. But there was enough around me, and I'd grown up, Madeleine Albright. I mean, you know, there's just so many examples. So I'd had a lot of exposure to what might a strong woman in power behave like. But actually, it was Ron Moore who did it. because he understood that Laura needed to find something in her that she'd never seen. And so I was kind of free to find her as opposed to model her, you know, on someone. And that was probably the right choice, I think.
Yeah, because Rosalind was thrown into it.
Right.
Right? Under these intense circumstances.
Right.
Where you're not only grieving, but you're also
dying.
And dying, exactly.
Sorry. Sorry to laugh.
That on top of it all, and grieving and stunned,
yeah.
But having to stand up and being put in a position where now you are making decisions that you never thought you would have to make, like, you know, right. Like leave the Olympic carrier, like you destroy the Olympic carrier because there might be a bomb on it or that type of thing.
And that's exactly right. That's a good example. Destroying the Olympic carrier in season one, that moment when Laura said, do it, to me was the first moment I think she understood that she was simply going to have to give up her own needs and ideas completely in moments in order to truly support the future of the human race. That was the moment where she started to change. And looking back on it now, because of you glorious people forcing me to take a look, it's not forcing, I didn't mean that. It is amazing how that moment led to this blossoming in her in the second half of season one. It's really cool.
And it's also moments like that. You know, it always struck me that Laura Roslin was a very moral woman. Like, she believed in things. She believed that she had a moral compass that she needed to follow, and that was what was going to steer her through the universe. But she also does a fair number of amoral, if not immoral, things. How do you, as an actor, sort of wrestle with that, making sure, I mean, I know a lot of it is on the page, but there's still a lot of it is what you bring to it so that we still sympathize with her while she's doing things that feel horrible?
Yeah, it's a great question. For me, the issue was I made a rule. Try not to abandon the dilemma while you're making the immoral decision. Sometimes we get seduced by a script and we get so committed to an action that we forget that the dilemma of the action comes with us, stays with us, we can't sleep with it after, we have to live with it. So for her, that was a big rule for me, is to keep the dilemma with me and don't lose sight of it, even though I don't have the freedom to be the kind of person I ideally would like to be. I don't think there is a president that's ever been elected, certainly to this country, who has the freedom to totally be the person that they would love to be. That's not the job, I don't think. Oh, that was heavy. Anyone want to laugh? No. I'm running for 2020. No.
there was a moment at the end of I forget what the title was, but the Astro Queen, when we're introduced to Tom Zarek, Richard Hatch.
Bastille Day,
yes.
Yeah.
And it was, it struck me because it was, at this point, Rosalind still new to this. And you know, she's got her feet, but she's still internally new to it. Where Adama has been living with being in power for a long time, in
military
power.
Since he was born.
Yeah. And it takes Apollo at the end to actually open the eyes of Adama and Rosalind in that one moment of going when he gives the Astral Queen to the prisoners in return for them going down to get the water to do this really hard labor and break up the ice because they're running out of water.
Right.
And he points out to you guys, you're like, you can't do that. And he goes, well, I believe in the articles, and he's the one that brings up the election and says that you're fulfilling Adar's term, and the articles say that in 7 months there's an election. Yeah. And if we don't agree with, if we don't follow the articles, then I'm not a captain, you're not a commander, and you're not the president, and I don't have to listen to a damn thing you guys are saying.
Yeah.
And it was just, it struck me, because in that moment it was like, wow, like, you were, not you, Rosalind was almost taking it for granted at a moment there.
Well,
that was an interesting
dilemma, because she worked for Adar for years. She knew all that stuff, but they gave the information to Captain Apollo. And so I had to back up and say, why wouldn't Rosalind know this? Do you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. But in that moment, dramatically speaking, it meant, no, she doesn't. So yeah, I hear you.
Yeah, there's those moments, right, where you're like, as an actor, you're like, but I would know this.
Yeah.
I know, exactly.
The first season, I mean, the show would eventually get to very dark places. But in the first season, there are still decisions that Rosalind has to make that are troubling. Did you personally find it hard to play situations where, say, you're airlocking somebody, which is a crime that you have to commit as the president? How do you navigate your own personal feelings about the actions your character has to make with the I guess, devotion to what the drama is going to be?
Sorry, what was the last part?
The devotion, what the drama is going to be.
Yeah. The airlock, it took me a minute, to be frank, Mark. First of all, I was so stunned by the idea of an airlock to begin with. You know what I mean? It was sort of like, how could that possibly be real? That you could eject someone into an infinite, the whole idea of it was so beyond my human comprehension. So I had to work really hard to kind of get familiar with, that was a device in war. And what I would do then, I found myself rationalizing all of this violence and all of these things that if you put me under, you know, up in front of a tribunal later on, might have been judged very harshly, do you know? But in that moment, I would always come back to survival of the human race, and nothing would have stopped her from airlocking Leoben. Absolutely nothing. And that was scary to realize. Mary had no problem with that. And I was like, oh dear, what is happening to me?
There's a line that she would not have crossed for the safety of the human race.
A line that she would not have crossed would have been if she had to be ultimately, I remember in the first season when Leoben whispers to her that Adama is a Cylon, and she never believes it, but it's frightening. And all of this is really new to her. And she and Adama are clearly not in love yet in season one. Although I was surprised at how intimate they'd get on the phone. I was like, wow, I didn't remember that. But
there are some googly eyes, though.
Yeah, like,
some googly eyes.
Loans you the book.
There's a little bit.
Gives you the book, doesn't loan it to you.
No, there were some sweet like moments. Are you there?
Yes, I'm there.
Well, what do you think? He wasn't an admiral. What was he? Commander.
Commander.
What are you wearing?
Yeah. But yeah. Yeah, exactly. Yeah, it was like that. It was like, well, what do you think? And he says, I'm not sure. And we would extend these conversations, you know what I'm saying? I thought, this is funny, this is gonna go somewhere. But to your point, what was your point? I'm lost, okay.
I too barely remember what it was. I'm now just imagining phone sex between Rosalind and Adama across the line.
Something I wouldn't do, cross the line.
Yes. Cross the line. What do you think she would not have done for the safety of the human race?
I think she would not ultimately have killed him, Adama. Because I think what started to happen was he became the place, they developed trust actually rather quickly, even though, I know we threw her in jail, all of that, but you know, whatever. That wasn't gonna last long, I knew that, you know. No, I didn't know that really. I don't know, I just feel like that would have been something, because then what would she do? But you know what, Mark? I think when I really think about it, there isn't. If it meant saving the human race, if it meant the survival of the species, she would have done probably anything, and I'm not kidding. I don't know how that feels spiritually in the long run.
But you know, Rosalind stood up to when they're putting the fleet at risk, trying to save Starbuck, and we've run out of time. And yes, she ended up making it. But you were the one, the voice of reason that came in and said, no, you guys are, you're not paying enough attention. This is the survival of the human race. You have to let it go. Yeah. And you were talking to the two Adamas about it. And but on that same kind of point, when we filmed in 2003, when we started filming, it was, you know, right after 9/11. Yeah. And so the poignancy of the show and the truths about the weaknesses and the, you know, the extremes of the human condition. Was there, you know, a particular moment that was really, really hard for you to film? And now, in, you know, looking back now, or rewatching the show now, it even has more resonance in what's going on in our world today with the, you know, the political and the divisiveness and the hatred and the, you know, the more prevalence of natural disasters. So it's not even just hatred, but also people losing their homes and their lives in fires and floods and everything like that. Do you think it would actually be harder to film now in 2019 than when we did?
I think it would be. I think it would be because we are really in it now. We are, whatever Battlestar was talking about, we are living it. Unfortunately, it was one of the things that was so extraordinary about it was we got to go from this incredibly terrifying, deeply upsetting, ground-shifting moment of September 11th into a narrative that demonstrated the potential future that this kind of hatred of the other, which is that's at the core of everything, and it is at the core of white supremacy, of everything that we are living through now. And we got to project, that's how I felt, Trish, was I felt like it was the opportunity to project our fears outward and put them into narrative. But if we were doing that now, I would spend all day considering airlocking people, then I'd go home and watch the news. I don't know, if, you know what I mean? It's sort of like, but in the environment, we are in trouble. Hopefully we will survive it. But I didn't mean to bring everyone down. Come on back. I'm just saying it would be harder, I think, don't you?
Well, one of the things that struck me when I've been watching it is wow, there's some, you know, and I know there was a moment in season two, I won't get too much into it, but, or season three, New Caprica?
Yeah.
And the Insurgents? And the Insurgents, that was really hard for a lot of people to film because it was flipping the switch on our, you know, the westernized world and who's we're being the suicide bombers now, you know, and all that. But now it just seems like there's so much more going on in this turmoil that to me it was like, I think there would be a few more moments of, you know, yes, we're acting, we're doing our job, but wow, it's really affecting me when I go home.
You know, I love that, Trisha. And you know what I would love? I sometimes think, what would Ron Moore come up with now? This is to you, Ron, whoever you are. If he created the next level and got ahead of where we are now on the planet. Do you know what I'm saying? Because we need guidance. We do, I think, you know, so. Maybe he could create something like that and it wouldn't feel so present, right?
Right. I mean, but that is the thing about great art, right? Yeah. Is that it feels somewhat temporally fluid. Like a thing that was true is truly true is always true. You know, so that you can watch a show that's 15 years old and it feels like it's today. You can watch a movie from 30 years ago and it feels like it's today. Anyway, it's talking about the human condition that seems to fundamentally not change. So, to flip it a little bit, because we've been talking about some heavy stuff, I've been looking online, because every TV show will kind of release the bloopers online, and so you can kind of watch, like, hey, it's your actors, favorite actors, like, laughing and screwing stuff up. I can't find Battlestar bloopers. Like, did you guys have
fun? I have them. I have them on a DVD.
You've been keeping this from me for, like, 3 years now?
No, actually, I just got them in my little hand, big hands. Our girlfriend of mine, Sharn MacArthur, who was a producer on the show, started out in the office, assistant in something, and then she ended up being a producer on it. She has this whole treasure trove of stuff in her garage. And I went over one day to help her clean out stuff, not just Battlestar, but she also worked on Caprica and Bionic Woman and Pitch Perfect. And so she has all this stuff. And she has like finale scripts signed by the entire cast and writers and posters and all this. And she has the Cylon head, the Centurion head that in the beginning that the art department made, and they would put it on a C-stand, and that's who we would talk to when a Centurion came in the room. And she has, so I was going through all this stuff, and I saw a whole bunch of discs of blooper reels. I was like, I'm taking those.
Good. Well, let's see them soon.
Yes.
Yeah. So, like, just monitoring and maintaining the tone on the set, given how occasionally bleak the subject matter can be, how do you modulate the mood of everybody? How do you keep it light? How do you keep it so that you don't contemplate ending it all at the end of every day? You know, like, how do you have fun on a show like this?
Well, I think Trisha is a good one to talk about this, because if you were in a scene with James Callis, you didn't have to worry ever about laughing. You had to worry how you were going to get your work done and how you were going to go beyond the extraordinary hilarity. I heard her laughing almost every day. Oh, he's making her laugh again. And mostly everyone in the show had a playful sense of humor. It was extraordinary that way. Like, part of it was we knew we needed relief. And so people would just like drop these really funny jokes in the middle of something, or it just had a playfulness, yeah.
And then, you know, there'd be certain scenes or certain days where there's much more heaviness to it, and or you've got a very emotional scene coming up, so you're kind of, you remove yourself from the situation of the crew and everybody kind of joking around to kind of stay in it or ruminate in it or whatever. But that's up to each actor individually of what works for them. But you're right, we needed to have levity,
yeah, me too,
on the set, so we did. And you know, the show was, there's quite a few funny people
there
on
really
the show.
There really were. And also, Trisha has it a little, Katie has a little, and I have it awfully, which is if I start giggling on a set, I cannot stop. Like something happens in my body, and it's like laughing in church, the ex-Catholic girl. I'm not ex-Cat, well, sort of. But the ex-Catholic school girl, let's put it that way, trying not to giggle in church. And you know, the minute you try not to, you laugh harder. So Katie Sackhoff, and you've probably heard about this scene, but it was this scene where, with Lee Oben, this should have been serious, you're talking about airlocking someone. And we said something to each other that made each other laugh. We still can't remember what it was. They had to shut the set down. The producer came in, David Icke, and he was really angry. He said, do you have any idea that what you're costing us? And I said, no, I'm so sorry. And we couldn't stop, and they had to separate us. And if you will notice, it was our, Katie and my scenes were very carefully placed throughout the seasons. So it could be a problem as opposed to a deficit.
And it could be just something weird that sets you off. I mean, it could be somebody trips. I mean, how many times it's a blooper that somebody trips or something falls down or somebody goes through a door and it doesn't open or, you know, and something just silly, especially when you're doing crazy long hours.
Yes.
That's when I always have the worst time, is when you're so tired,
yeah,
that something sets you off that really normally isn't that funny,
yes. Yes.
But you're laughing for 5 minutes.
Oh my God, I just remembered one. We have this amazing director, Anthony Hemingway.
Oh, I love
him. Anthony Hemingway is one of the biggest dudes in Hollywood, really,
oh, yeah,
in television. He's just, yeah, a genius.
This is one of his first gigs, I think, wasn't,
yeah,
it?
Yeah, well, he did, you know, he was David Simon's AD.
Yes.
And first started as stage manager when he was like 18. So he apprenticed under David Simon, The Wire, obviously, right? And then he became a directing producer for him. But anyway, he came up to Battlestar, and it was his first episode with us. This guy has a laugh like Santa Claus. Like, if he laughs at the camera, the whole place shakes, right? Well, we didn't know that. I knew it a little because I could hear him. But so this is a very serious, serious scene. And I'm sorry if it offends anyone when I tell you this story, but it was Adama and Laura sitting in Adama's office, They were kind of, you know, they were close by that point. And they were having a drink, whatever that stuff was. I don't know.
Ambrosia.
And Laura was at the beginning of losing her hair from cancer. So my action was to be talking to Adama and just, you know, unconsciously go like this and see hair in my hand. I mean, it's a big, poignant moment. I went like this. I saw some hair, but I didn't really look really. And I hear from this director, and the whole crew starts laughing. What had happened was they planted a whole lot of hair in my head so that that can come out gently and carefully, and I'd grabbed a giant chunk of it. And I hadn't really paid attention. I was so busy acting the moment that I didn't look down to see I had like a mountain of hair in my hand. And so this moment that was supposed to be and truly is such a painful moment for every woman on the planet during that process of breast cancer or any cancer, when a woman loses her hair, it's a deeply, deeply ground-shaking moment. We had to stop. We had to take a breath. We had to start over. So those things happen even at the most tragic moments, you know?
We're going to go questions in about 2 or 3 minutes. So if you have some, kind of circle back around and kind of line up there. And keeping in mind of the kind of things we've been talking about, like Trisha said, don't like want to spoil stuff. Don't ask questions we're not going to answer. You know what that feels like. Before we get to those, I just kind of wanted to get a sense from you of what you think the legacy of Laura Roslin is. What do you think, looking back on even the beginning of the show, looking back on all of the places that the show was able to take you, to the Peabodys, to the United Nations, to stuff like that, what do you think the legacy of Laura Roslin is?
If Laura Roslin has a legacy, I think in looking at her now, it's that she can provide a guidepost for bringing that which is intuitive and feminine into the realm of the patriarchal power without abandoning it and keeping the intuitive as part of the decision-making and the power paradigm, because she really didn't ever abandon her feminism, her feminine. And we had in the culture up until that moment, we've had certainly beautiful leaders, female leaders in Star Trek, and, you know, for sure. But in terms of human beings, we didn't, I think women, I grew up in the feminist era, and we wanted to stay, you know, hot and everything, but we did think it was a trade-off. We thought we were gonna have to trade a lot of our feminine intuition and sort of the way that we behaved and the way that we think in order to be able to compete in the male paradigm. Patriarchal, let me call it that. Men and women are very different from those, you know, ideas. So I think the fact that she brought her feminine to the power as opposed to abandon it. And I've had a lot of people feedback on that, so maybe that, if there is a legacy, might be part of it.
Yeah, I mean, it's...
Does that make sense?
Totally. Yeah. There is a temptation when writing a character like that, especially in old school Hollywood, to just like, we wrote it as a guy and then just made it a lady.
Exactly. I've seen them. I've tried to play them. Do you know what I mean? And you read the words and you say, excuse me, I don't think that a woman actually speaks like that. And they'd say, well, she does in this. Well, yeah, but she doesn't. Well, she's going to. You know, we want to make her more like the guy. Come on, she's got power. She's got to be like the guy. And that just did not happen with Ron.
Yeah.
He refused to do that, actually, you know? I'd sort of like, hey, can you make her a little tougher? I mean, you know, can't I just walk in and wipe up the room with these people, please? And he was like, no, you may not. And he was right, thank God.
All right, we got our first question from the audience. Who are you? Hi.
Hi. My name is Lissa, and Battlestar Galactica is one of my very favorite shows ever, and I have so many friends that are mad at me for introducing them to it. But my question is, who on the show did you not get to work with as much as you would have liked to? Who in the cast?
I paid her. Secretly, I just paid her behind the couch to say that.
I needed the money. I've been out of work. No. I had to get my insurance. Sorry, go ahead.
No, I wanted to know which of the cast members would you have liked to have had more scenes with or more interaction with?
Well, my answer is quick in general. I will say all of them. Because Laura did have a little bit of an isolated existence. And so there were literally weeks would go by that I would be in LA. And then I'd come up and do three scenes, and then I would be gone. So when I look at the overabundance of talent and extraordinary people, now when I watch, I'm sort of like, oh, man, couldn't we have figured out a way to, like, couldn't she learn how to fly a fighter pilot or something, you know?
I had that as well, because Six yeah. was so isolated with Baltar for most of the series, but definitely in the first half of it.
Correct.
And while I love James Callis to the moon and back, there's so many people, characters, and actors that I didn't work with at all for ages. So yeah. My answer would be the same as yours, for sure.
That is true. And then when you started playing all the other women that you played, oh my God, you were more on the ship, you were more interacting with different people, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, really, like in the fourth season with Natalie, my Natalie character, then I'm like, I'm finally getting to be in a room because either if before that it was me alone with Adama, or like as Shelley Godfrey, or something like that, but actually be in a room and present.
Yeah.
Because Head Six was, she might have been in the room, but she was not there, you know.
Oh God, that was hard. You try and pretend that Trisha Helfer is not standing in your eye view and pretend she's not there. That is really what took the most skill of Battlestar Galactica.
It's so hard for actors too, if you always say clear the eye line, especially in emotional scenes, because you'll sometimes have the crew, they're just offset, but they're in your eye line, because you're supposed to be looking out over this vista or something. You know, I just had this with Lucifer and my character's death, and Amenadiel and I are supposed to be sitting on a bench looking out over the vista of LA, and I'm about to die. I don't know it, but we're having this heartfelt moment. And we start taping, or rolling, and I look to take in the view, and there's a crew member with his phone and gum going. I'm like, guys, clear the eye line, clear the eye line. So, but in the scene.
We couldn't clear the eye line.
You couldn't clear the eye line, and there's this, I'm just like looming over top of them.
Yeah, I remember doing a scene on the Colonial One, and I think this was in the first season, where Trisha was literally on my desk, like this.
Yeah, you're behind
like
the desk.
Close to me, and I'm like, talking to Dr. Baltar. I'm like,
I'm in a very skimpy blue dress.
I know, I'm like, cool outfit, you know? It's hard. Anyway, thank you.
Thank you.
Hey, buddy.
Hey, my name's John. And the question I have is, so what was the thread or the connection that made all along the Watchtower the signal through all the different seasons? It was the signal that they were following. It was the song that the human human Cylons had. And what was the deal that how did that come to be, and what was it talked about amongst the cast and crew, or was it just a song that was picked?
I think Ron Moore loves the song. I honestly feel like I've never heard a deeper explanation. Yeah, I mean, you know, who doesn't love that song? It was a brilliant song. I think Ron would have a very articulate answer to that. But I'm sure it was Ron. It might have been Bear and Ron. Bear, you know, brilliant Bear and brilliant Ron. But
Bear McCreary did the music, for the composer, for those of you that don't know.
But I don't know. Maybe Eddie knows.
Yeah, maybe Eddie knows.
Eddie probably chose it.
Although what Hogan's story...
But which one?
When we were in Florida, about, because he's hearing the music, his story about...
Oh, that's right. Yeah.
It was amazing.
I know.
We're not going to tell you here, sorry.
Yeah, we can't.
You know.
Just between us girls.
Hi.
Hey, CJ.
Hey, Mark, what's up?
How you doing?
My question is for Ms. McDonald. You said Rosalind has like a very strong sense of responsibility. Is there any other fictional character you think she would get along with? Like from any universe, Marvel, DC, Star Wars?
I think she would have gotten along with some of, frankly, I'm not good to answer that because I don't know the other characters well enough in terms of what you're saying, but I do know that some of the women from Star Trek over the years, I think she would have connected to intellectually.
Have something that sort of.
I really do. And I'm actually going to be doing a podcast with some of those women soon, so it's going to be fun.
Oh, fantastic. Yeah.
Women of sci-fi.
That's awesome.
Like leaders. Yeah.
I think Laura Roslin would get on very well with Peggy Carter. I think Peggy Carter's, one of my favorite quotes from a character in a Marvel movie is when Peggy Carter says that she always lived her life by compromise when you can, and when you can't, don't. And that feels very Laura Roslin.
Yeah, it is. It is. It's right at the core.
Yeah. So I think they'd be fast friends. And they were both redheads. So, yeah.
Welcome. And do we have...
Any other questions?
Yes, we see.
Hey!
Hi, my name is Eric, and...
Oh, hi.
Hi.
Sorry.
No, that's fine. That's fine. I had a question about the finale, but I'm supposed to keep it to season one, so...
It's tough.
Exactly. Yeah,
you're
it is
stuck.
Tough. But, okay, so... Fantastic show, and I love everything... The social commentary could get really deep with everything, and one of the things that I think worked really well through all of the seasons was trying to not just look at everything from both sides, but look at everything from everybody is the hero of their own story. And I'm wondering what you would think if Battlestar were made today. Would that still work in the kind of the political, social environment we're in today? And how might that be different than the way it was done 10, 15 years ago?
Can I say something? Do you mind?
No.
You know, I think it's a great question, and it goes back to what we were talking about before, about the relevance of how would you write that today? What would be the difficulty? And I think it would be an even more complex but profound idea. Because the idea that every individual is the hero of their own story also has to do with the idea of inclusiveness and tolerance and not pointing at the other story and saying that's wrong because it isn't mine and creating narrative around cultures that work very hard as they did in Battlestar to maintain inclusiveness. All the stories, when people struggled with the other on Battlestar, there was always someone there confronting them or leading them back home, literally, to a more openness. Today, it would be almost like, it seems to me it would be profoundly important, but it would be even more critically lethal to continue to push those boundaries in front of people at a time when the doors are closing. So you should write that idea. How about that? No, what do you want to say?
No, I'm good.
Yeah, I mean, that is the way drama works, right? Is that every character is a hero of their own story. When it gets tragic is when the hero realizes that he's the villain. You know, and most stories don't do that. Most stories don't get you to that second place of the hero realizing that he's been the bad guy all along. And I think that if you're doing it today, if you were going to try and mount it today, it's that recognizing your role in the drama while the drama is unfolding. And that you have the agency to change that if you want. You know, one of my favorite characters of literature is actually Gaius Baltar, because he's driven by his own desires and by his own desire for self-survival, that he is both the hero and the villain, and at times realizes he's both, and maybe believes he's neither. And that what makes him so wonderful.
Yeah.
And more of that.
I agree with you. That's a perfect answer. More Gaius Baltar dilemma, because we're in that dilemma, all of us, on some level, right? And it was beautifully drawn.
And when we feel for the way the world is going, it's because we realize that maybe people don't realize who the villains. You know, it's like, oh, don't you understand what you're doing? Don't you understand how this is affecting people? No. And that's when we get angry. So that's...
I think there's someone I know well that we all sort of know that knows exactly what he's doing. Unfortunately, just had to say.
Amen, sister. Hey, buddy, you have a question?
Yes, I'm Aaron.
Hi, Aaron.
So, ironically, I'm recently rewatching the first season with a friend of mine introducing them. And I noticed, I think, what really sucked me in from the very beginning, and it is the acting. You're all wonderful. There's no weak link on that show at all. But in the original miniseries, it was the believability of characters in crisis. And yeah. How did you get to that mindset? And at that point, you know, as the show goes on, you get a little bit more used to your situation, the characters do. To get that crisis, was there a lot of reshoots to get like, hey, we got to get this right?
No. No, there wasn't. There wasn't a lot. I mean, we took a lot of time leading up. Like, it's not like we just kind of, oh, let's shoot it and there was a lot of discussion prior to scenes. Sometimes I think to the crew had we made them annoyed a lot because there was so much discussion before we actually started filming of making sure that everybody, and it was the most so far the set that I've been on that is the most kind of collaborative. And so you took what was on the page, and then we literally would just sit there and do during blocking or even before blocking, which is where you kind of put the show on the scene on its feet, is we would talk and talk through the themes and what's going on and how we're struggling with something in it, or the, you know, the character's struggling or the actor is struggling portraying that. And so I think we did a lot of work before we actually filmed, as opposed to going back and fixing things.
Also, the reality that Tricia mentioned before, and I think Mark did too, is that we were, as a culture, traumatized for the first time in my lifetime as a civilization, as a culture. And so you start working from the trauma that you feel over time through both the narrative and in reality in the States and everywhere else. You start to come out of trauma. You come out of shock and you start to get the work done and try to find a way to integrate what you learn. So the timing of the show felt completely natural.
I don't know why this just popped into my head, but yeah. Probably because I was just watching Culber's Last Gleaming and there, the Starbuck character, for instance, you know, she's so strong throughout, and she has her moments when, you know, when the pilots are all killed, and she has to teach new pilots, and it brings up Zach's death and everything. And so there's moments of vulnerability for the character, but she's still the fighter pilot that just keeps going and keeps her head to the ground, you know, not head to the ground, but just keeps going. And then there's a moment in Culber's Last Gleaming, after she's fought like crazy with Six, and they've just fallen off the edge, and you know, she's, Six has died, and she sees Hilo on the planet, who's been left alive, and he's alive, and she sees Sharon, and in that moment, she realizes Boomer is a Cylon, and all that, and Starbuck breaks down, and starts like sobbing, and Hilo holds her up, and it was like it's those moments where that character, that she broke there, you know?
Yes.
But she, it, you know, something else, because maybe it's her programming, it's her military training, it's her fighter pilot training, that she's gonna keep going. She's gonna keep going and pushing through and pushing through and pushing through. And then there's something that takes her a step down and she has to recoup from.
Yeah. We have time for one more question.
Hi,
hey.
My name's Eddie. And I noticed that, while there are so many amazing female characters in Battlestar Galactica that are so strong, they're so frequently isolated from each other. There are so few scenes that it seems like any of the women got to have with each other at all, and I was wondering if you guys think that was sort of a product of its time, and you're seeing that in work you're continuing to do, you're getting more scenes with other women, or are we still getting these like isolated female characters that just play to a room of men and don't get to have friendships or rivalries or kind of interesting moments with other women?
Can we do another 2 hours? right, Trisha?
Yeah.
It's a great question.
We did talk about
that. We did talk about it. We would like hide in a trailer and talk about it. We did talk about it because it was a difficult thing. It was how intentional it was. I don't think it had a negative intention to separate the women and isolate the women. I think it was truly a sensation of truth in the world as it evolved. And the culture that we grew up in, certainly in the entertainment industry and the narratives, did that a lot. So to suddenly, I think, shift that all at once might have seemed like a self-conscious maneuver to make this about strong women who were all friends and yada yada. However, you're right. We struggled with it a lot. I remember talking to Ron about it and David and Michael Reimer. And I think Trisha did too. I had a hard time with the fact that Laura Roslin didn't have any friends. I was like, why? Do you know? And they were like, well, she's president, you know, you can't really have friends around. I said, well, I'm not sure that's exactly true, but then I understood the arc was really starting to maneuver itself, I integrated that loneliness into part of her growth of power. And I think that happened with you. And I think I saw it with almost every female character found a strength in the isolation. And perhaps that was kind of a genius of that particular narrative. I really think it might have helped some of the evolution. I don't know. What do you think?
Yeah, I agree with you. I mean, Six was a little bit different in the fact that... Yeah.
Well, she was having, you know, she had a friend.
She had a friend. And she was very dedicated and devoted and focused on that friend.
She's so in love. Yeah.
Thank you so much for your question. Thank you, everybody, for coming to this live taping of the Battlestar Galactica cast. I would like to thank Patricia Helfer, my wonderful co-host.
Yeah. Thank you, Mark Bernardin, my wonderful co-host.
Mary McDonald, give it up! Thank you. And thanks for the good folks at Sci-Fi Wire for helping us make this a reality. Thanks, everybody. Good night.
Thank you, guys.
Yeah.